Our next guest set off on a philosophical journey through the world of religion, exploring the thinking behind our belief, our unbelief, and points in between, and how the concepts of God or godlessness work out in our thinking and our daily lives.
In a series of interviews, he talked to philosophers from a variety of traditions, believers in different religions, as well as agnostics and atheists. Throughout the year, he's posted those interviews on the Stone, a philosophy section on the New York Times website.
Gary Gutting joins us now. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame and a regular contributor to the Stone. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
So why did you set off on this project?
Well, I was especially interested in the fact, which I cited it actually in the first piece I wrote about, with the fact that a large proportion of philosophers, at least in the main United States departments, are atheists. That surprised me. Philosophers are a skeptical lot. I would have thought most of them would have been agnostics, as a matter of fact. So I was looking more for why up to 70% of philosophers in surveys say that they're atheists. And so I talked to about half of the people I talked to were atheists. And then others were various sorts of believers in Christianity or other religions, and try to get a sense of what was going on.
So what's the value in trying to apply reason to our system of belief or non-belief, whatever it might be?
Yeah, you have to do that if you're a human being for any beliefs that you've got. This is not peculiar to religion. It's also, you find it with regard to ethics or politics. I mean, obviously, people do have certain rock-bottom beliefs. Philosophers sometimes call them basic beliefs. That's just where they start from, okay? And maybe belief in God is like that. Maybe belief in a whole creed of a religion is like that. Whether or not it is, your basic beliefs give rise to further questions. First of all, there's questions about what logically follows from those beliefs. You believe several things. What are you committed to in virtue of that? Or you get challenges from other people whose views you might respect, or at least that you have to come to terms with. Or you find out about scientific results that seem to be in contradiction to what your beliefs are. You have to think them through. So everybody needs what I like to call intellectual maintenance for your beliefs. So regardless of whether there's total rationality and everything's all derived from reason, which may well not be true, is not usually true for us, anybody's system of beliefs, if they're taken seriously, need various forms of intellectual maintenance.
You say we have to do this, that we need this, but you also write that in your concluding piece that religious faith without a strong role for critical reason readily falls into fanaticism. How does a lack of that reasoned examination belief lead to fanaticism, maybe destructive behavior?
Yeah, well, that's when you're refusing to take account of any alternatives, and you also start deriving conclusions which might be ethically very bad about, you know, like unbelievers are bad and they must be eliminated or something of that sort. And then you just get into a set where you aren't able to you aren't willing to to consider any alternatives to the system of belief that you've got. And then that can be very, very bad because there's no control. And again, I say that's true not only about religious beliefs, it's true with political beliefs, it's true with ethical beliefs. There's lots of beliefs that people have, which if they aren't subjected to some sort of reflective, rational control, they can get out of hand.
One theme that comes up in your series of interviews, there have been efforts over the years from atheist philosophers to prove that believing that theist belief is irrational,
yeah,
and vice versa, believers trying to prove that atheism is irrational. Is this a productive line of questioning and argument?
Well, it's not productive in the sense that you might hope that we get a decisive answer in which everyone finally agrees. That's certainly that certainly does not happen. That doesn't happen in politics. It doesn't happen in ethics either. It doesn't happen in most of the most interesting questions that we're concerned with as human beings. But it has resulted, I think, in considerable clarification of the beliefs, in considerable resources for thinking about what we believe and why we believe it. In other words, for helping us with our process of intellectually maintaining our beliefs, for working on them, developing them, and so on. Yeah, it's done a lot of good things that way.
Well, it's interesting to think when we encounter a different belief system, it seems like one path might be, as we learn more about it, we might drift away from our own original way of thinking, or the encounter with something different might actually reinforce what we believe to start with.
Yeah.
Can you talk about those two alternatives a little?
Well, those two things can happen. I can be very concrete about it. I've always been to, in some meaningful sense, since I was born, associated with the belief in Catholic form of Christianity. I've been further away from it sometimes, closer other times. What in recent years has brought me closest to it is spending a lot of time thinking about and writing about the criticisms of religion by the new atheist movement. I think once you start to see how weak those criticisms are, you start to get more sympathetic, or at least I did, with religious points of view. So that's one way that it can go. Can go just the opposite of what you might expect, actually. But on the other hand, many people have had a belief in say a particular religion, and then got and had fallen away from it and had doubts about it, and then got that reinforced when they read, a lot of people read somebody like C.S. Lewis. Now, he never terribly impressed me, but a lot of people read that and say, wow, that's really clarified Christianity for me, and made it a lot more plausible. Other people have maybe been even religious in some sort of way, and then they read Richard Dawkins, the God delusion, as he calls it, and they're blown away and think, my God, this is so right. Well, I guess they don't think, my God, this is so right. But they say he's just so right, and atheism is obviously correct. He's got a very strong following of people who find him extremely convincing. One thing I've tried to do is suggest that he's not nearly as convincing as they might think he is.
Now, a lot of people might think, you know, or maybe not even consciously think, but do religion in a way that, you know, the religion is their daily or weekly practice. They go to church, they have a certain set of behaviors, prayers, devotions, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And this egg-headed philosophy stuff doesn't really enter into it. Is there a case that the practice is as important as the fundamental beliefs?
Yeah, well, in fact, in the final interview, so-called, that wrapped it all up, I allegedly interviewed myself, right? It's a little disconcerting thing to do. You have to keep yourself honest. But one point I brought up there, which I'd often thought about before, and that many of our many of my interviewees, both and incidentally atheists like Philip Kitcher at Columbia, and also many actually strong religious believers like Howard Wettstein, who's Jewish, but also says that he's a materialist and he's a naturalist. That is to say, I shouldn't say materialist, I mean naturalist, and doesn't think there are any supernatural beings. They all emphasize, and I would emphasize it too, that for almost everybody, religious belief starts on the level of practice. I mean, you don't just start out saying, wow, here's a great argument for the existence of God, so I'm going to believe in God. You start out usually by engaging in the practice of one or another religion, either born in it or you get interested in it from friends or you just are curious and you go. And I think, let's put it this way, for most believers, even the strongest believers, I think the very root of their belief is this. Practicing this religion, that is, living according to its precepts, engaging in its rituals, its prayers, its way of thinking, reading things that are written by people that are from its tradition, it's a good thing to do. I get something out of that. Certainly, I would say I would remain, I think it would always remain a Catholic, and always have, simply in those terms. I think I get a lot out of a close association. For me, it's especially the Catholic intellectual tradition, the writers like Augustine and Aquinas and Newman and those sorts of people. That means a lot to me, and I think it's important for me to read about those people and to think about them and to reflect on those doctrines and try to apply that in my life and so on. So I think practice is the starting point. And then I think the next thing is that obviously the doctrines have a lot of they make a lot of claims, right? They make what seem to be factual claims. They tell stories that they say are true. They give you doctrines about the Trinity, the Eucharist, and so forth. I think those can be very successfully used. And I'm not exclusivist about this. I think the doctrines of many different religions can be used to better understand aspects of the human situation. I mean, take the evil that's in the world. We try to come to terms with it. Well, you can read what is basically a very brilliant story, the book of Job, and you can learn a lot. You can understand a lot about evil from it, whether or not there actually was this God who spoke to Job, who had these terrible things happen to him, the devil was involved, and so on. That's all another matter. But just as you can read a great novel and come to understand things, you can learn a lot in the way of understanding from these doctrines. So you can get all of that before you get to the level of, are these doctrines actual factual truths about the way the world runs? And I myself am pretty agnostic about most claims made on in any religion about that this is actually the fact of the way the world was created, or this is the being that's behind it, and that being is exactly like this. I'm a religious agnostic. That is, I practice religion. I like to think in terms of religion. I think that part of my religion is saying I don't really know much about any of that, those actual factual details.
We're talking to philosopher Gary Gutting. He recently explored belief systems, including major world religions and agnosticism and atheism, in a series of interviews published on the New York Times website.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you worked with interfaith groups or explored belief systems different from yours? Do you think there's room for common ground among different faith groups or between believers, agnostics, and atheists? And do you believe in God in some way? And what does that exactly mean to you? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst.
We continue our conversation about religion, belief, and philosophy with Gary Gutting. He's a philosophy professor at Notre Dame, and he did a series of interviews on the New York Times website looking at different faiths and belief systems around the world.
And you can join the conversation. How have your own beliefs evolved through your life? Have you checked out a belief or non-belief systems different than your own? Did that challenge your worldview or reinforce it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Green Bay. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to sort of make a statement. You know, I'm first generation Vietnamese American, and I was born in Arkansas, and my sister was brought over at 1 year old. And me and my sister were First Southern Baptist, but my parents are 100% Buddhist. But we were adopted by a church, you know, adopt a family because of the war. So from the research I found and what I've been exposed to, it's really where you're born. Like a big part of it is where you're born and raised, obviously.
Interesting. So Gary, a lot of our religious belief is the happenstance of our birth, or in this case, our adoption into a religious faith.
Yeah, that's really interesting, the situation Mike is in, because he has, in a way, a heritage of the Buddhist faith, but he's lived out one in terms of the Baptist faith. It is true. I mean, one of the first ways to get yourself thinking about your religion is to ask yourself, supposing I had been born in Vietnam, supposing I'd been born in Saudi Arabia, supposing I'd been born in communist China back in Mao's time, what would be my religious beliefs? Well, they very likely would not be similar to what you have. That's certainly true. So there's a danger, I think, in any highly exclusivist way of thinking about religion. I think any intellectually plausible way of any intellectually responsible way of thinking about religion has got to say, look, this is one way of thinking about these truths or these realities that are beyond the world, but there've got to be other ways too, and I'm not going to be able to say that this is the only way or the best way. I think you have to be open to that. I don't see where exclusivism gets you anywhere. One of the atheists I interviewed, Philip Kitcher, formulated, and he's not the only one who has formulated this, but it's a very good challenge. It says, look, and a lot of the new atheists like to make this point. They say, if you hold a strong particular sectarian religious belief, you actually deny the beliefs of all other religions that contradict your belief, which they usually do. Now, think about it. Do you have any better reason for accepting your religion's belief then the people who are in the other religious that have been raised in those other religions have to believe theirs. If you were in their situation, wouldn't you have their beliefs and wouldn't you be equally entitled to it? I think that's a very strong point. And it got to lead us, I think, to a non-exclusivist view of religion.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. And we'll go now to Tim in Wisconsin Dells. Tim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for calling. Thank you for taking my call. Anyways, I didn't grow up religious at all by any means, and fell in love with a girl from a very, Catholic family. And for 6 years now, I've been doing communion because I thought I was supposed to, because they would drag me to church. And it finally came about where my brother-in-law asked me why I was taking communion, and the whole family's been talking about it for the last 6 years. Since I'm not Catholic, I was just trying to be nice. But anyways, my wife isn't. She doesn't practice anymore either. She doesn't believe in it. But she turns into a completely different person when she's around her family, and we have to go to church.
Uh-huh.
And it just makes me feel uncomfortable. So I was wondering if you had any advice.
Interesting. When in Roman Catholicism, do as the Roman Catholics do, doesn't actually apply in that particular situation. But trying to fit in with a religious tradition that isn't our own. Interesting situation, Gary.
Yeah, that is true. And sometimes I think you do have to be polite. New atheists are often not polite, and often will just be very critical. There are a lot of religious people, especially of a fundamentalist sort, that are like that. But you can't. I mean, I don't think you should be deceitful. And I guess I would say I wouldn't go to communion if I didn't believe or didn't think I should be practicing that particular religion. Wouldn't want to be acting as though I believe something I didn't believe. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to just flaunt my lack of faith in situations where other people would be made very uncomfortable by it.
All right. Well, good luck sorting that out, Tim. We'll go back to our callers with Ellen on the line in Milwaukee. Ellen, hi.
Hi. Oh, so good to talk to you. I grew up hearing the names Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, and, very unusual kind of upbringing. My father was a Irish Catholic from Chicago, professor of philosophy, a Thomist, and he raised us very, very strictly, so none of us wanted to be Catholic. I especially didn't want to be Catholic because I was a girl, a woman. And I didn't like, I said, I'll be a Catholic when I can be a priest, Dad.
Yeah, you don't want to be a member of an organization you can't be in charge of, right? I mean,
yeah. But in the past, dozen years or so, I've been finally realizing that I am Catholic by culture. My values are Catholic. I hang out with Catholic or ex-Catholic people. And the other thing is that I am now dealing with the question of evil. And knowing that I'm going to have to get deeper into reading or something. My sister died this year, a couple months ago, and she died she was not sick. She died as a result of being given care in a very, very poor care place. Mm-hmm. And it was excruciating to watch her get sicker and weaker and then die. And so I believe I was in the presence of evil going through this experience with her. And it's really affecting me. I'm trying to find meaning in life. But anyway, just the two things. I accept my Catholicism by culture happily. I don't like the dogmas. I don't go to church. But I see myself as a cultural Catholic, and I'm finally grateful for that heritage.
Wow, Ellen, thank you so much. A lot there, Gary. And Ellen, I'm sorry for your loss and the experience with your sister. But Gary, take that where you want to go with it.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate what Ellen's saying here. I think often the notion of cultural Catholic is used in a very a deprecatory way. You're just a cultural Catholic or whatever. But I think Catholicism is almost above all a cultural phenomenon, more even than it is an institutional phenomenon. I myself don't have a great deal of sympathy with much of what goes on in the institutional church. And the hierarchy, I don't think, is or should be definitive with regard to how I think or what views I take. But I do have a huge respect for that. It's not just intellectual. It's artistic, it's ethical. The whole culture that's been developed over 2,000 years in the Catholic Church, and I think that that's a very important way to be Catholic. And I, one thing I would encourage is that I think that people who have a sympathy for some of the rituals and want to go to church, even if they don't have a doctrinal belief or they don't have a sympathy with the hierarchy, I think they should, there's no reason they shouldn't regard themselves as part of the Catholic Church. There are many different ways of being Catholic, and some of them, and some of the best are deeply rooted cultural ones.
Thanks a lot for that call, Ellen. And Gary, you and Ellen have a situation probably a lot of people have some permutation of sorting out what are my spiritual beliefs. Do they fit in with the hierarchy or the institution, whatever the faith may be? Is this one of the big questions of our time?
Well, it is a big question, I think. I think that there is a very important question that's interesting also, and I think a lot of people are interested in this. Do we have to have religion, or maybe more broadly spirituality, does it have to be associated with the institutional structures of churches? Churches, of course, have a vested interest in saying, absolutely, if you're not belonging to one church or another, and some of them, they're rather broad-minded now, so you can pick the church you want to belong to, but you should belong to a church. I don't know. Is the religious impulse, is our desire for a spiritual life, is that necessarily best fulfilled in the institutional structures of these social organizations that we call churches? One thing I learned when I talked to people that knew a whole lot about Eastern religions, especially Buddhism and Hinduism, was that those religions are frequently, they have a strong social basis in society, but they don't have anything, often they don't have anything nearly like what the Catholic Church or even some of the Protestant churches have in terms of a fixed institutional structure. So I'm not sure that this is a necessary part of religious life, and I think a lot of people get pushed away from religious life because they think it means belonging to a church.
Well, Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be here.
That's Gary Gutting. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. You can find his series of interviews on religion on the New York Times website. It's part of The Stone. That's their philosophy blog.
First, we're talking to a guest who says we live in an era of irrational parenting. Despite a downward trend in crime statistics, many parents today are afraid to let kids go beyond their front yard without a grown-up along. Jennifer Senior is the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She wrote about irrational parenting for New York Magazine. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
So why do you think that modern parents are irrational?
Well, I will say my editors put that headline on there. I'm not sure I would have gone quite so far and made such a sweeping statement about all about all parents. I think the point is this. When it comes to safety, there are certainly cultural trends involving parenting that do not seem to be, that don't seem to correspond with what the data suggests, right? The data suggests that it's never been a safer time to let your kid play outside. It's never been a safer time to put your kid in an automobile. It's never been a safer time to let your kid walk home from a public place. And yet, we are hovering over them. We are barely letting them walk or ride a bike to school. We are incredibly protective of them in ways that suggest that the crime data would look the exact opposite. So the question is why? And the answer, I think, has to do with a variety of things, but I'll just give one for now. We defer having kids. If you're a college-educated woman, you're not going to have your first kid until you're 30. And your husband, if he's college-educated, is going to be 32 years old. And I think what this does is it makes us look at children as this enormous kind of life event and investment. We just assign a lot of significance to this experience once we finally have kids. And it makes people, extremely kind of protective of their investments in ways that they might not necessarily have been if they'd had like five kids starting from the time that they were 22.
But maybe that's a good thing, right? Maybe this hypervigilance that parents have about kids is the reason that these statistics of harm coming to kids are so low.
I would have said that, but there are two things that absolutely flat out contradict that. I mean, I looked into that thinking, well, maybe all this helicoptering is paying off. First of all, not only are stranger abduction rates falling, Abduction rates within families are falling. You know, families are more likely to abduct kids than strangers are, and those are falling at an even faster rate, right? So why would that be the case? You know, the other thing is that crime rates generally are falling. And adults are certainly taking advantage of this. I mean, now as an adult in New York City, a woman, I walk around at 3 in the morning by myself in neighborhoods that my parents would never in 100 years have imagined would be safe, right? We are all doing this. We are all taking advantage of plunging crime rates nationally. But we're not letting our kids take advantage of it. I mean, and if they're falling across the board for, you know, if they're falling for adults, there's no reason to assume that the trend lines would be any different for kids. And nothing seems to suggest it is.
Well, if you look at some of the media coverage recently, it was maybe about a month ago, there was some parents on the East Coast who let their children take a walk by themselves, and they're getting an unsubstantiated child neglect charge. So maybe the pressure is coming from places other than the parents themselves.
Now I think well, when you say other than the parents themselves, actually, I mean, what's fascinating about that particular case, which was in Silver Spring, Maryland, two kids of scientists, right, who embraced kind of the philosophy that a kid ought to be able to roam free, were walking home from a park, and they were not in any kind of imminent danger. They were picked up by the cops not because they were in danger, but because another parent had called the cops. So I think that actually, in a funny way, there's just this culture surrounding parenthood that's extremely burdensome, I think, for many of us. Jerome Kagan, the developmental psychologist who did, like, some of his best work in the 70s, in the, I guess, late 80s or early 90s, he wrote an essay that was very prescient. He said that in public life, there is almost no way to establish yourself as a moral person anymore. You know, it used to be that we took care of our aging parents, so our neighbors could see how wonderful we were because we did this. Or we were involved in neighborhood organizations and civic groups so everyone could see, you know, that we were willing to make a difference. And civic participation has gone way down. We now, you know, put our parents in old folks' homes and things like that. The only way to show our moral worth today is through our parenting. That's how we strut our plumage. And I think that that has created this culture of surveillance and judgment and censure rather than one of collaboration and, you know, helpfulness. And I think it's not doing any of us one lick of good.
Why do you say it's not doing us any good? I mean, I guess I'm not arguing that it is doing us good, but is it actually doing us harm?
Well, first of all, you have two kids who were picked up by the police, which is in and of itself like quite traumatizing, right? I don't think that helped them. Those kids were perfectly safe walking home. Their parents had made a perfectly rational calculation that in their extremely safe neighborhood, in broad daylight, after school, it was okay to walk home, you know? And instead, they were greeted by a police car. And the police themselves, and Child Protective Services themselves could find absolutely nothing wrong. No imminent signs of danger. They came up with nothing. So to me, that's not doing anyone any good. It's suddenly scarring the kids. It's throwing into question for them whether or not their own parents have their best interests at heart. And it's kind of creating this incredibly weird, scary memory of a police car coming by and picking them up. I'm not sure I see how that works out. I mean, I think we'd be much better off if we were just simply mindful of kids on the street and made sure that they got to where they were supposed to be safely and all agreed that we were going to have our kids walking around in groups. I mean, I think that helps everyone. It helps them foster, like, a sense of independence, right? Then they actually feel like they're capable of doing something because, you know, you don't want to inhibit them and think that they are capable of doing less than they are capable of doing. And it also, you know, sort of creates an esprit de corps among parents where they feel like they all have everybody's kids, you know, in their sight lines, and that they're all going to be helping out and pitching in.
Well, taking a look at that sight lines issue, that's something that's maybe changed over the past decade or so, as you have more two parent families who have both parents working. And so, in other words, there's not someone who's watching the street at all times. Is that something that you see as changing things?
Yes, definitely. And I think that a lot of this is about anxiety about women actually being at work and the fact that there aren't as many eyes on the street. I think that that's certainly true. Nevertheless, you know, when women were home, you know, back in the 70s. Kids were told to get on their bikes and to, you know, not come home until supper time when they banged a gong. You know, and back in 1969, 40% of all American kids were walking to school or biking to school, and now it's about 13%, so it's much lower. So I do think that there's certainly anxiety about it, but, you know, just because parents are there doesn't mean that they're paying attention, by the way. It might just be a signifier of our anxiety, not like actually a material, you know, not materially consequential in any way.
It's hard not to be critical of parents, no matter what the age is, because if you look at the, you know, the our parents' generation in that time, you might say, oh, those parents neglected their kids. They didn't spend enough time with their children. They didn't play with their children. You know,
talking
to parents who said, my dad never played with me. Why does my kid want, you know, you to play with him or her? So, I mean, isn't there always some critique we're going to make? And maybe we just overcorrected for the errors of the past.
There's definitely the thought that, like, maybe the needle is now just swinging the other way, and that, you know, we were all raised by a generation that looked maybe not quite like Betty Draper and Don Draper and Mad Men, you know, where they're, like, tossing back vodka tonics and telling their kids to watch TV, but maybe something like that, and so we're going to be much more engaged. I mean, maybe, you know, it's possible that it's compensatory, and certainly it's every human's instinct to gossip. But, you know, I think that there are, I don't find this a particularly constructive form of criticism or gossip. I think that, you know, telling your 10-year-old to walk home in broad daylight in one of the safest neighborhoods imaginable, you know, it just doesn't strike me as a particularly dangerous thing. And I think having a bunch of, you know, local gossips call the cops on you is just not particularly constructive or helpful.
We're talking right now to New York Magazine writer Jen Senior. She says we live in an age of irrational parenting. Well, at least we overblow the dangers to our children when it's actually a really safe time to be a kid. So, Jen, is this something that other countries, other cultures you see struggling with, or is this uniquely American somehow?
You know, I have not looked at data around. There's a really beguiling chart in the UK that shows the same kind of circumference around a kid, you know, that it used to be the kids could walk 6 miles if they were 8 years old, then they could walk one, and then they could walk a block, you know, I mean, it's the same thing. But I don't know what that data looks like internationally, and I'd be very interested to see it. And, of course, there are different norms in different cultures and different bikes, you know, bike usages, and, you know, it's going to depend on cities versus countries. So, you know, it's an interesting question. It's one I should look into more.
You were talking some about the morality issue earlier, that when we parent, and we parent maybe in an overly protective way, that it's somehow establishing our moral authority or our moral worth. Who is it, do you think, that we're trying to display that for?
Other parents. I mean, you know, think about what your Facebook feed looks like and all the weird kind of competitive tensions that are subtly kind of woven in. I mean, not in mine. I don't tend to follow or have friends like that. But, I mean, I think that people are, you know, and that's what Pinterest is kind of predicated on. I mean, there's a lot of ways that I think a lot of parents want to establish, you know, how great they are at this. And, you know, I think anxiety about being a present parent, if you're working, is certainly one very poignant reason people might do it. You know, but again, like, I go back to the idea that we used to have other ways of showing this. When we were more involved in public institutions and at civic organizations and neighborhood organizations, and when we took care of our own aging parents, you know, people saw what we were doing and the kinds of, you know, family men and women that we were. And it's harder to see that now. We're all super busy and working a lot.
Well, we're talking right now with New York Magazine writer Jennifer Senior about why she says parents are overprotective when right now it's a safe time to be a kid. And we want you to weigh in on this. Do you see parents obsessively worrying about the safety of their children? Do you think parents today are irrational when it comes to the risks of childhood? And if you're a parent or a grandparent, what do you think? How do you behave with your kids? Are you super concerned about safety, or do you like to go a little more free range with your style? Call it 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with Jennifer Senior about how she says parents are disproportionately obsessed with the safety of their children today. And we're taking your calls. What do you think has contributed to an age of maybe irrational parenting? If you're a parent or a grandparent, how do you make sure your kids are safe without going overboard? Do you agree that parents are too obsessed with safety, or do you think it's a good idea to be vigilant? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We go to our callers now. We've got Peter on the line in Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good afternoon. I blame this helicopter parent routine or syndrome pretty much on the advent of the Internet. 20 years ago, if something happened, you might read about it in the paper, and maybe your mother-in-law would send you an article about something like that. But now, well, you were referring to that couple who was investigated for letting their kids walk home from school, and I can't even remember where that was, but we wouldn't have known about that 20 years ago. So I think a lot of it is the information that gets distributed on the Internet that normally wouldn't have been seen not very long ago.
Hey, Peter, thanks a lot. And Jen, is there something to that? Does the sensational stuff tend to get passed around more?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And this is something that I wrote about pretty extensively in my book, that I was really surprised by how many people were spooked by, number one, the 24/7 news cycle, which includes, of course, lots of stuff that you see on Facebook and the Internet as well, where, you know, one kidnapping story in one place, which gets, you know, kind of sensationally replayed over and over again, right, on cable news, becomes, it looks suddenly as if that's kind of normal and not an exceptional experience. That's one thing. The other thing about the Internet, I was surprised when a part of my book takes place in Texas, and I remember talking to all these mothers in Texas who are in these beautiful, ravishing, lushly landscaped neighborhoods. It couldn't have been nicer, upper middle class, and they wouldn't let their kids be on their front lawns. And Texas has a transparent, it's got an Internet sex offender registry. So you can see where all the sex offenders live in your neighborhood, and you'll find them. You know, that's what happens when you've got Internet transparency. They've always lived near you, but now we can know their addresses. And, you know, sex offender is a very kind of broad term, but doesn't matter, right? Like, you just immediately know exactly where their address is. You know it's a mile from your home, and you panic. So I agree completely. What's strange is that more information in this case, or exposure to more information in this case, doesn't necessarily make us behave more rationally.
Well, thank you for that call. We're going to go next to Felicia in Sun Prairie. Felicia, hi.
Hi. My question was, I have kids in the Sun Prairie school system, but when we were in Canada, we received paperwork that said that 30% of girls, or females rather, in the United States, up to, I believe, by the age of 21, 30% have been sexually assaulted, and 20% of boys. So my question is, how do you tell your kid, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't there to supervise you, this is why this happened to you, when you know that 30% of females, this is going to happen to?
Great point. Thanks, Felicia. And, you know, we hear all the time that knowledge is power. You have knowledge like that about the statistics. As a parent, you feel like you have an obligation to protect your kid and be there, don't you?
Yeah, of course, of course. Number one, there's a lot of kind of, there are conflicting bodies of statistics and data about exactly what about sexual assault rates. I don't want to get into whether or not those numbers are right or wrong, and I don't want to minimize or trivialize how very real that problem is. I will say this. Being sexually assaulted in broad daylight while coming home from school is much less of a problem than being sexually assaulted at a party that you yourself drove your kid to, or while your kid is home alone while you're not there with another kid. You know, those dangers tend to be from kids that other kids know, right? That's where things get bullying at the hands of other kids, assault at the hands of other kids, those are much realer dangers. But they are not about sending your kid outside. To me, those are separate questions. So she's raising a very profound and important point, and it's a much more devilish problem to contend with. But in my mind, it's because it's driven by, like, kids you know and trust, or parents of the kids that you know. I mean, this gets hairy very quickly, because we're not talking about, like, letting a kid walk home from a park most of the time.
Felicia, thank you for that call. We're talking right now to New York Magazine writer Jen Senior about how parents today tend to overestimate the amount of risk to their children. And we go next to a caller in Milwaukee. Linda's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I was just listening, and I just listened in, but I'm wondering, your guest mentioned sex offenders, but I just saw a program about human trafficking, and they gave this huge number of how many persons go missing every year. And they talked about how it's not a safe world anymore to allow your children to just be out and about, because across all lines, children are being taken.
Thank you so much for calling with that, Linda. And yeah, we've got sex offenders, we've got human traffickers, and we know all this because we watch TV and we read stuff on the internet. So as a parent, if you're the one who gets caught with your guard down, you're going to feel terrible. Is it better safe than sorry in this case?
I mean, I think that the human trafficking story was in the news because there's a bill right now, you know, in Congress about this very issue. You know, again, I would go back to the fact that the number of children who are abducted every year is still very, I mean, let's put it this way. It's much more unsafe to get into a car with your kids, right? Much more unsafe. And the odds of getting into a car accident with your kids are much greater than your kid being, suddenly snatched away from you and shunted into some kind of sex trafficking ring. I mean, you know, these are not even comparable. You know, the odds are, it's probably much riskier for your kid to be on a bike. You know, it's much riskier. And unfortunately, and I'm not saying that these harms don't exist and that there isn't a small chance. I mean, in the way that there's a chance that I could slip and hurt myself in my bathtub, everything is associated with a certain level of risk. But this is, in a funny way, a little bit like what I was describing before, where I said we see a report on television and decide that it's emblematic of a larger trend, when in fact, actually, I'm sure that that piece was on TV because there's a sex trafficking bill right now in Congress that wants to penalize people who've actually, you know, wants to impose stricter fines on people who've been complicit and helped, and, you know, and it's now getting snagged in all kinds of, you know, Republicans and Democrats have different ideas about what they want to append to it. It's actually not really about the inherent harms of sex. I'm guessing that the impetus for that story wasn't about, oh, gee, oh, my God, the world is filled with sex traffickers.
And just in our last little bit of time here, just a few seconds, what should parents do if they want to loosen up this culture a little bit and give their kids more leash to roam on?
You know, I wonder if, like, you know, parents in particular neighborhoods ought to just start talking to one another and saying, why don't we all agree that today they're going to walk to each other's houses? You know, that they're going to, like, kind of go in gangs of three and four. You know, I mean, that's one possibility. You can have them walking with each other and checking in. You know, you can decide that, you know, your 11-year-olds are all going to walk somewhere as a group. I mean, there are small things you can just do, making the decision within your own neighborhood or with friends, with other friends, you know.
And we leave it there. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We were speaking with Jennifer Senior, the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She wrote about irrational parenting for New York Magazine.